Chapter 13, Harry and Chuck. My growth as a candidate notwithstanding, I had a big political problem on my hands in those early days. I was running more or less against the wishes of the D.C. Democratic establishment, personified by Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and Senator Chuck Schumer, chairman of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, the DSCC. The DSCC can make or break a Democratic Senate candidate's campaign. They make a judgment about whether you're a good candidate, whether you're running a smart campaign, basically whether you have a shot at winning. And that judgment matters because even though they won't generally put out a press release declaring you a loser, they make their opinion known to influential politicos. So if the DSCC doesn't like you, analysts might reflect their pessimism in the horse race-obsessed coverage that dominates the news. You might have a hard time getting your calls returned by major donors who may have heard that your race might not be a great investment. You might even have trouble getting senior staff to sign on because the world of Democratic operatives is small and nobody wants to spend months on a campaign only to lose. And then, of course, when the general election heats up and it's time for the DSCC to start running ads and investing in field operations, they spend their money strategically. The last thing you want is to find yourself being pummeled with negative ads in October and have the DSCC shrug its shoulders because they think they'd be throwing their money away. Obviously, the DSCC doesn't want to throw away a seat either. So they don't usually settle for just being disappointed in the candidate they end up with. Instead, they tend to intervene below the radar to make sure they get a candidate they like. And if you're not a candidate they've specifically recruited to run, trying to earn their support can feel a lot like a hostile job interview. First, I met with Harry Reid. I had never met the soft-spoken majority leader before and didn't know quite what to expect. The first thing Harry asked me was, "How do you make a living?" The question didn't completely surprise me. A lot of people don't know that the comedy they see on television is actually written, especially on a talk show or even a sketch comedy show like SNL. So I explained my career as quickly as possible. It occurred to me a few years later that Harry might have been pulling my leg, so I asked him if he had been joking. Harry said no. It's a good first question. Some guys have no way to make money while they're running and do funny things with campaign funds. He meant funny illegal, not funny ha-ha. Anyway, after I explained the comedy business to Harry, he passed me off to Chuck. I had known Chuck Schumer since college, where he had seen me in a one-act play in which I had played a character named Bernard, who became transformed whenever he called himself Spike. Since I lived in New York for quite some time and traveled in Democratic circles all my adult life, I'd run into Chuck many times over the previous 3.5 decades, and he'd always start each interaction by calling me Spike to remind me that he remembered the play. I found this slightly irritating, but also kind of adorable. The day I went to see him in the Senate, he greeted me with a grin and a hearty Spike. And then things took a turn. Chuck was very candid, telling me he and the DSCC were not excited about the idea of my running. "We should have a 60% chance of winning this seat," he explained. "You have about a 40% chance." I made my case. I told him all the groundwork we had laid, the size and enthusiasm of our rallies, all the money coming in. But Chuck was looking for someone else and even asked my opinion of a couple state legislators he was thinking of recruiting. Both were friends of mine, which I explained to Chuck, not sure what else to say. Chuck nodded and apologized for being so frank. I told him I appreciated his honesty, which was absolutely true. At least I knew where he stood. And Chuck never called me Spike after that. While I would need help from the Democratic establishment to win in November, I had my own plan for becoming the DFL nominee. With or without Harry and Chuck on board, it was full speed ahead. Minnesota's primary was scheduled for September 2008, but traditionally the nomination is won when a candidate is endorsed at the DFL State Convention, which was scheduled for June 2008 in Rochester. The endorsement process was set to begin on February 5th, 2008, at local precinct caucuses, where DFLers would meet in their neighborhoods and choose delegates to move on to their Senate district or county conventions. At those regional conventions, delegates to the state convention would be elected. And in Rochester, those state convention delegates would join superdelegates, mostly state legislators and party officials, in voting on which candidate to endorse. If you got 60% of the state convention delegates, you got the party's endorsement, effectively becoming the nominee. Because I announced so early, February 14, 2007, we had nearly a full year before caucus night to get ready. What was our plan? Simple. Do everything we could to appeal to the people who were likely to show up on caucus night and participate in the complicated multi-step delegation selection process. The Beanfeed regulars I've been getting to know since returning to the state. Meanwhile, develop relationships with superdelegates and compete for the support of unions, environmental organizations, progressive advocacy groups, and other groups whose endorsement carried a lot of weight for party members who were likely to be politically active. Now, if all of this seems a little dry to you, imagine instead the training montage from a Rocky movie with a driving soundtrack and energetic editing. But instead of jumping rope, I'm eating hot dish at an assisted living facility that traditionally has high caucus turnout. Instead of guzzling a dozen raw eggs, I'm being driven 5 hours to speak for 5 minutes at the Otter Tail County Convention. Instead of hitting a speed bag, I'm playing phone tag with a state representative who's on the fence. Exciting. The grizzled veteran in charge of our field and outreach operation, my Burgess Meredith, if you will, was 25-year-old James Hager. James had worked on Paul Wellstone's last race in 2002, and like many young and not-so-young people who had poured their hearts and souls into that tragic campaign, he was initially hesitant about joining mine. I mentioned earlier that Paul's life and the tragic circumstances of his death and the ugly political aftermath made every step in my political journey feel a little heavier. And I was just Paul's friend. The entire Minnesota DFL community was full of people who had been at headquarters that October day when the call came, who had worked side by side with Mary McAvoy and Tom Lapek and Will McLaughlin, the staffers who had died in the crash, whose entire political consciousness had been shaped by the work they did for and with Paul and Sheila Wellstone. And for them, it's impossible to overstate just how much Paul's memory hung over our 2008 campaign. So when you tried to hire those people, you weren't just asking them to help you. You were asking them to trust you, to live up to Paul's legacy, and to carry on his work, and frankly, to avenge him a little bit. And that's a lot of trust to ask for, especially if you're the kind of candidate who is prone to, say, yelling at a prominent political reporter about the use of the word motherfuckers. It took a few weeks to convince James to come aboard. But when he did, he worked like a guy who had a lot more at stake than just his win-loss record. He put in 18 or 20-hour days, 7 days a week, plowing through the pile of cheap candy that was always on his desk, and staring up at a whiteboard that listed which way all the key players in the state were leaning. Key players like Tom Rukavina, the hilarious and irascible curmudgeon who represented a big slice of the Iron Range in the state legislature. Story about Tom. He was once in a parade, and a guy he knew called out, "Hey, Tommy, why do you only care about the poor?" Without missing a beat, Rukavina responded, "You are poor, dummy." I may have been focused on the kind of patient grassroots organizing and relationship building I would need to win the DFL endorsement, but I wasn't ignorant of the extremely valid concerns that Chuck had raised about my chances in the general election. Early on, we hired a pollster, Diane Feldman, another Wellstone veteran, whose job it was to help me figure out the right way to talk to the broader audience of Minnesotans about who I was and what I wanted to do as their senator. We also needed another media consultant since Mandy was still tied up with Hillary, who was still battling Obama for the presidential nomination. After a few meetings, we hired Saul Shore, a garrulous bulldog of an ad man from Philadelphia, who was almost more excited than I was about going after Norm Coleman. With the team in place, it was time to get some data. The first internal polls we took roughly matched the public polling at the time. I was down by double digits against Coleman. As we convened our focus groups in the summer of 2007, Our goal was to figure out how to get around the fact that I had an awful lot of edgy, dark, or off-color jokes on the record. Republicans had continued to process joke after joke through the dehumorizer, blasting each one out in irritating press release after irritating press release. The question was, how could we fix this? At the focus groups, Diane handed people a packet of information about me and asked them to underline the stuff that stood out to them. At one session in suburban Edina, she prodded a bit at the part about my using foul language to attack Republicans, rereading that section aloud. Franken has a history of using inappropriate language, including the F word, and launching personal attacks against public figures, including many sitting members of the U.S. Senate. For example, he once said that Republican politicians are shameless dicks. At that, a woman sat up in her chair. Oh! Diane pounced. Is it the F word or... There are a few uncomfortable laughs. I read what was here, said the woman, turning red, but I thought it was shameless ducks. The focus groups were helpful in determining a strategy for handling what, from then on, was inevitably referred to around our office as the Shameless Ducks Dossier. The results were actually pretty surprising. A few of the folks understood that I had been using the language for satiric effect, but in general, they were not terribly impressed that I had spent my entire adult life writing stuff like that. They didn't think the fact that I had been a successful comedian meant that I was intelligent. So it turned out that telling people I went to Harvard was a good thing, because it reassured them that despite having no experience in politics and having called some people some bad names, I was probably at least smart enough to handle government work. It was the first recorded instance of it being a good idea to tell people you went to Harvard. The books, it turned out, were also a good thing. People liked that I had written books, because it showed that I had several books worth of serious thoughts about public policy in my brain, or at least that I had the work ethic to finish writing several books. Basically, the results we got from the focus groups were Harvard and books good, comedy bad. This called for a slight change in strategy. For example, Dusty had tracked down a pallet of kazoos somewhere, and when Team Franken did parades around the state, we had our supporters march, playing Ring of Fire and other hits on kazoos. We had fun, but after the focus groups, the consultants made it clear, get rid of the kazoos, unless we could find some kazoos with the Harvard logo on them. Dusty said he'd look into that. As summer turned to fall, I had company on the campaign trail. Back in April, Mike Cerisi had announced his candidacy. Mike was a successful trial lawyer who had represented the state of Minnesota in the big lawsuit against the tobacco industry, famously pressing the case until the tobacco companies released damaging internal documents and in the end securing a $6 billion settlement. So Mike was well known and also rich and a serious candidate, my main rival for the DFL endorsement. But not my only rival. Jack Nelson Pallmeyer was a professor of peace studies at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul. Tall, white-haired, and distinguished in that cardigan sweater, corduroy sport coat kind of way, Jack's campaign was built upon three clear issues: peace, the moral urgency of addressing climate change, and single-payer health care. I was for all those things in principle, but felt that some of his specific proposals, for example, a 50% cut in the Defense Department budget, were not just unrealistic, but irresponsible. Then there was Jim Cohn, an effusively friendly gadfly, who had once run unsuccessfully for the U.S. House in Connecticut. We'd show up at events, and he'd proclaim, "You don't have to be rich," talking about Mike, "or famous," talking about me, "to run for the Senate." The crowd agreed, but we're also a bit confused about what, having stated what he wasn't, Jim did bring to the race. The four of us found ourselves all showing up at the same events, my blue and yellow signs competing for a space with Mike's yellow and red gear, Jack's green, and Jim's none. Meanwhile, I continued to update Chuck Schumer on our campaign's momentum. We were raising a ton of money, we were rolling up endorsements left and right, and we were taking it to Coleman as best we could. Chuck was happy to hear that things were going well, but still not particularly interested in getting behind me. But over the summer, we'd followed some advice, really a command from the DSCC, and conducted another poll to test our theory that the Shameless Ducks dossier was survivable. The results came in, and when we saw them, we breathed a sigh of relief. Armed with our poll, we scheduled another trip to Washington to sit down with Reed and Schumer and make our case. At the meeting, we carefully explained that while Minnesotans did have concerns about my history of questionable humor, we had found a response that worked. Reed interrupted, "What kind of jokes are we talking about?" We all looked at each other, not sure what to say. Reed tried again, looking at his notes. "It says here, Franken made jokes about the Holocaust. What does that mean?" Diane Feldman handed our poll to Harry and pointed to the joke we had tested. "I think a bad Hanukkah gift for Anne Frank would have been a drum set." I watched Harry closely as he read the joke and then burst out laughing. In fact, he started shaking with laughter. It was a surreal moment, sitting nervously with my consultants, watching Harry Reid convulse in hysterics over the idea of Anne Frank playing drums in the attic. Finally, he turned to me. I just shrugged. Now, oddly, it wasn't even my joke. It came from original SNL writer Rosie Schuster, and it found its way into a piece that I got credit for.